friends. We had a little like 1,100 square foot house, and we would pack 20 to 30 people in there every Thursday night to watch The Office. And I would be lying if I said if you tried to talk any time except in the commercials, you were not invited back. So you had one chance, and then the next chance, if you can't even talk during the commercial, not during the commercials, like you just, we changed it on. But seriously, we had friends from church, we had friends from work, we had friends from the past, and it was such a beautiful picture of community coming together and people connecting with people that they didn't normally connect with. And I missed that with television, ironically enough. But toward the end of The Office, it started to fall off. I don't know if you guys, we're not going to talk all about The Office, but I need to share this with you. Toward the end, it started to fall off. And people thought, writer's strike, people thought, it got too ridiculous, all of these things. But what I think happened is, like, everybody loved Jim, right? Jim was a great character. And Jim's life got real, okay? Initially, Jim didn't care about the job, he came in, he was cracking jokes, he was all that. All of a sudden, Jim gets a promotion, and he gets married, has a kid, and all of this stuff that he had put off and he had kind of mocked throughout these years became real. And then another thing happened, a job that he was always able to do easily, he started to fail at. I'm not going to make you watch the birthday cake episode, but where they try to celebrate a birthday, they try to combine the cake, and it's just a horrible tragedy. But as viewers of The Office, when Jim started to care about work and he started to fail, that started to make us feel it wasn't the awkward funny anymore. It was the, this feels too close to real life. I don't want to watch it anymore. And so we responded by not watching it anymore. That's where a lot of us are today. We're living in that struggle of, like, life is too real for us. And also sometimes we see where God is at work, but really it's hard to see where God is at work in our work. And so we try to disconnect and we put our efforts into other things. And that's not bad, but it's also not good, and it's not as good as it could be, and I don't think it's what God intended for our life. Like, God intended for us to be able to bring ourselves to work. God intended for us to be able to serve Him in any amount of work that we've done. That's really great theory, I found that getting from that theory to reality, and what does that mean, and what is the next right step, can be super difficult. And so today we're going to talk a little bit about that theory, but I'm not a theologian, and I don't pretend to be. What I want to get to is there's a framework that I've come across that I've started to use in my life and in my business, and it helps recognize where God might be at work in your business and where you can really make a difference. And so we're going to share that, spend some time talking through that too. So... I have a question for you, and this is not like, I want you to turn to somebody that you're sitting next to, meet somebody new real quick, and I want you to ask them two questions. What was your first job, and what purpose did it serve? Okay? No, for real.
What was your first job?
I just want to say,
This picture has a smell for me. It is the smell of ammonia, and not just a little bit. The first time I put on an N95 mask during COVID, I was in the Publix parking lot, and I was transferred directly back into this chicken barn, and I stumbled in the parking lot. I was not expecting that. But my first real job was collecting eggs from 40,000 chickens. The purpose of this job was money for gas, food, and clothes. I literally measured the hours by cash in hand. So I would look and see, like, all right, on a Saturday, I knew if I could get to 6 hours of work on a Saturday, I could fill my truck up. And that was the goal for a Saturday. But I never saw past that. I never saw what I was really doing. And so a few weeks ago, as I was preparing for this talk, I thought, man, what was the real purpose of that job? And so I went back, and the bigger purpose, so on average, we would gather about 30,000 eggs a day, okay? Each egg intended to be a chicken, so these weren't eggs to eat, these were eggs to become chickens, and then those chickens were to become food for people. And so, assuming gluten-free breading, we were generating enough chicken nuggets a day to feed all the elementary children in Williamson County. So, and that was my first job, all right? But cemeteries predate chickens for me. My dad has been a bivocational pastor since 1985. We might call him a solopreneur. He'd be kind enough not to roll his eyes at us. He's both pastored and ran a monument company almost my entire life, which means I grew up in cemeteries. I never thought it was weird, but I did get kind of in trouble one time in kindergarten because I was drawing tombstones with my names on it because that's what we did at work, and teacher thought that was a little weird, and she was probably right. And all of the people that know me in this room, like, this is making so much sense. it's answering questions. So this is where we're going to start today. You see, all kinds of people walk through the door of my dad's monument company. Rich people, poor people, couples, kids, widows, widowers, everybody. We had one lady that couldn't afford a tombstone, and so we were able to get her a small marker, and she paid us with plants that she had in her house, because that was all that she had. Most days, the conversations didn't stay within what we would call normal business either. I don't think my dad meant for the monument business to be a ministry. He needed it to feed our family. But God had bigger plans. And if you think about the people and the situation that they're coming in that moment, there was as much counseling, there was as much care, there was as much, biblical conversation in that time. Then I saw a church through the church that we were a part of. So I grew up between the office, the cemetery, and the church. And again, looking back, I saw more ministry at the office than the church. And I think that's okay. Honestly, I think it's really good. Because especially today, growing up, it was always this idea, like, oh, we can invite friends to church, and we can invite friends to church. Like, how? Who are you inviting to church? And I think that's still a thing that we can do, but I think now more than ever, we're taking the church with us to work. And that's, work isn't just about ministry either. It's about, like, how are we showing up as believers in work, but then how does that play out in our work? And so again, that's what we're going to talk about today. Now, the Monument Company wasn't all just fun ministry conversations. It was hard work too, like digging foundations in cemetery lots when it's 102 degrees outside, or when it's negative 10. Oh, it was never negative 10 in Kentucky, but it felt like negative 10. The grass of the ground was frozen. Like, that was really hard work, and it was toil. But again, it was good. So I'm going to, sorry, we're going back and forth here, and I really apologize about the audio. There's a little bit of clicking going on, but you'll need to hear this. So.
Faith also gives you a concept of the dignity and worth of all work, even simple work, without which work can bore you. He says, in other words, the people who do the simplest kinds of work are actually the fingers of God, Luther says, or the masks of God. God's loving you and doing things to you when he has chosen to do through the work of other people. And therefore, all work is actually God's work. It's God's way of caring for his creation. Faith also gives you the concept of...
Okay, you don't have to listen to any more audio. All work is God's work. And I think we hear things like that, but we don't really think about what that means. We don't think about what that means for our work, or at least I didn't for a long time. And so I want to talk a little bit about the state of work. Work existed before the fall. Genesis 2, 1 and 2. Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the seventh day, God finished his work that he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work that he had done. And then Genesis 2:15. The Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and keep it. And then Genesis 3:17-19. And to Adam he said, because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten of the tree of which I commanded you, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return. I'm never a fan when people like just pull out verse here and there. So I would encourage you, go back and read Genesis 1 through 3. I don't know when the last time you read that, but read it through the lens of work, and it shows up in a real different way. Work existed before the fall. For some of you, that's like the most basic thing, and you're like, I am going to leave, and that's fine. But for some of you, you may just be thinking about what that means. Work was cursed during the fall. We just read that. And so we live in this state right now where work is both good and cursed. A lot of Tim Keller in today's talk. In short, work, and lots of it, is an indispensable component in a meaningful human life. It is a supreme gift from God and one of the main things that gives our lives purpose. But it must play its proper role, subservient to God. It must regularly give way, not just to work stoppage for bodily repair, but also to joyful reception of the world and of ordinary life. And then work has dignity because it is something that God does, and because we do it in God's place as his representatives. And so why do we start with our first jobs? Because a lot of times when you look back on our first jobs, those were the least dignified jobs that you had, other than the disc jockey, which was super cool, right? And so if we as Tim Keller says, if we can look at our first jobs and look at some of the simplest jobs that we've had and understand how they play a part in God's greater purpose, then we should be able to play that forward into where we are today and how we are a part of God's greater purpose today. Pointing in just a little bit, your work is good. Again, a very simple statement. My daughter is doing a research project right now, and she's coming up with a thesis statement, and she brought me this thesis statement. What do you think, Daddy? And it had like 10 8-syllable words. And I was like, I don't know what these words mean, and I don't think you do either. Go back and write it with 8 syllables, and that's all you get to write a thesis statement. I think to understand something, really, we have to break it down to its simplest core. That's the old designer in me. So your work is good. And so I want you to think about what you do for work right now. And I want you to think about it as good. Maybe you already do. That's great. The next one's for you. Your work is broken. Maybe that's your job. Maybe it's your industry. Maybe it's your workplace. But it's broken. And the tension of this is where God intends us to live. And even invites us into, like, part of how he's making all things right. The brokenness is your invitation. How many of you guys are familiar with kintsugi? And I don't even know if I said that correctly, because that'll show you how familiar I am. It's the Japanese art of repairing broken pottery by mending the areas of breakage with lacquer dusted or mixed with powdered gold, silver, or platinum. Okay? So one of the things I read about this, it says, rather than trying to hide the damage, kintsugi highlights the repair. The imperfections are what make it beautiful and valuable. A broken piece that is put back together has more of a story, seems more authentic and real, is stronger and more resilient than something that has stayed pristine. The breaking of what once was, the layered and time-consuming process of putting it back together, the mending it with gold, all contribute to its new value. And surprisingly, it becomes more resilient after it has been mended by kintsugi, even stronger than it was before. Our work is broken. It is cursed, but it has the opportunity to be beautiful because God is making all things right, and that includes our work. It includes your work, and the brokenness is your invitation into that. Nice, Josh. Great. Good words. So what? Where do I start? If we are being invited into God's work of making all things right, what does that even mean, and what do I do? That's the questions you should be asking, and maybe where you stopped asking questions. There are countless books written on faith and work. Theologians and pastors and people with more letters after their name than I have in mine have said more and better things than I can imagine on faith and work. I'm not going to attempt to do that today. But today, you're stuck with a marketer, a strategic one. So while I don't have all the big words, I do have a framework. In my conversations with people about faith and work, there's a very practical problem. It's not that they don't get it or believe it or even want it. It's that they're stuck. They're all knotted up, and they don't know where to start. And so I have a framework for that. Ought, is, can, will. Before we dig in here, you should know that I don't make a habit of bringing a framework to a gospel conversation. I'm not going to talk about spiritual discipline today, but that's a huge part of all this. So don't run off and be like, all right, now I have a framework. I don't need to talk to God about this. Without time in the Word and time with God, this framework is just some cool words. But added on top of that, it can be really helpful in discerning where God is at work in your work. Okay, ought, is, can, will. This is my favorite framework. I work with Mike Schatz over there. I've made him do it several times. He's heard me talk about it a bunch. So the fact that he's still in this room is encouraging to me. I thought he might walk out. And we've used a lot of frameworks. So this brings order into the chaos of our work, our problems, our industries, and so much more. It helps us organize all the information from a problem into more digestible chunks and discern what we can really do about it. It literally brings faith into your work. Let's dig in. Okay, so the four components, the first is ought. Okay, ought is what should it have been? Okay, who hasn't heard begin with the ought in mind? Actually, it's begin with the end in mind. But ought is a super awkward word. Don't blame me, I didn't make it. They ought to have come up with a better word, I guess, but I digress. And so that's why I describe it as what should it have been? Like when we're looking at a problem, I think when you're talking about this initially, I think it's most helpful to think about the industry that you're in, because the industry most likely has existed longer than you, it's existed longer than your company, it's existed longer than everything. So if you can think about the industry that you spend most of your time, I want you to think about what ought to that industry have been. And so when you think about things like that, you think, I think, as a marketer, I think, oh man, Courtney's gonna do a session next hour on redemptive marketing, and the fact that my industry needs a session on redemptive marketing tells you what's wrong with my industry. We use all kinds of things to sell products. Sometimes we use lies to sell products. We manipulate data, we countless other things. Those are all should not have been, right? We should be able to present our product, and it should, if it wins the day, it should win the day. We shouldn't have to convince people. Another way to look at this, since we're in a room of believers, is without the fall, what would this look like? Have you ever considered your industry might exist in eternity? Not going to talk about that today. Just want to lay it in the room and think about like what should it have been. Okay? The next is. What is it right now? Is tends to explore the current brokenness of the situation or problem. The funny thing about this is once you hear this, you're going to go into your office or wherever you work, and you're going to talk to people that you work with, and you're like, well, we should have done this. And you're like, I know where that goes. And you're going to say, well, the problem is that, and you're like, I know where that goes. And you start to hear things differently, and it gives you a pathway to organize what's going on. And oftentimes, when is invited into the situation or is brought into the situation, it's talking about the current state of brokenness with the work. Fourth is will. So normally you go 1, 2, 3, 4. I am not capable of using a framework without making my own edits to it. And so I'm gonna present it like I like it, and then you can change it back if you want to. Will is what will it be when it's perfect? And so some of you said it'll never be perfect. And guess what? You might be right. But we still should have a view of what it'll be when it's perfect. And so when you look ahead and you look at like, oh my gosh, if we do everything the right way and all this stuff comes together and everybody's amazing and all of, like everything works, this is what the state of my industry will look like. And you hear that too. People want that a lot. And I think this state, understanding this state, is most key to understanding where you can engage brokenness, because this, thinking about what it will be when it's perfect, leads to hopelessness if you don't know where to put that in the story, okay? Because if we're not perfect, the people we work with aren't perfect, our industries aren't perfect, and if our goal is perfect, that can be hopeless, right? Still needs to be considered, because that still has to be that goal that's out there. And then finally, going back to number three is can. So can is what can we affect now? Can looks at the opportunity we have to bridge the gap between is and will. Because when we have is, we have what is broken, and we have what perfection looks like, then that balance, that gap, is the change that we are being invited into. And if you can harness and understand what can be done, then you have your opportunity to really affect change. And I also think this is where God is at work in your business most often. And it's where you can join him. Okay. So, ought, is, can, will. Those of you may have heard of this or have already like figured it out, but this aligns very well with the story of the Bible of creation, fall, redemption, recreation. And we, as believers, even right now, are in this moment of redemption. We are not in recreation. He's making all things right. We're past creation and fall. And so it only makes sense that we would be participating in this can state in our businesses too. Okay? So, what I'd like to do for probably the next few minutes is talk about how this affects your industry. I'd love to, if anybody is interested in throwing out some options. While you're thinking about that and building up your courage, I'm just going to give you an example of how it worked at our agency. So I run a marketing agency. I've already established a lot of brokenness in marketing. So one of the things that when we think about running through our particular business, we ought to run a profitable agency with a sustainable work-life balance for our team. See how nice that feels? This is what we ought to do. And everybody's like, yes, let's do that. Agencies are known for burning out their people. They're known for all-nighters. They're known for, hey, come there. If you can survive 2 years, then you can go and coast anywhere else, right? Like that's what, and we on the other side are like, all right, let's see how much we can get out of our young talent before they get burned out and have to go somewhere else. I've done that. Like, I've facilitated that. It's miserable. Because just when you get somebody that's ready to really take over something and drive, like, they're done. They don't want to work there anymore. They want to go somewhere else. And then you have to go and hire like new talent, raise them up. And you never get to a point of expertise. You never get to a point of growth because you're just always restarting. Is our team feels overworked. We are writing off work that's not good enough. Our profits are suffering. That sounds horrible. So let me tell you how that works, okay? So we overwork our team, right? But they only have the capacity to do so much good work. And the rest is just kind of banking hours a little bit. And maybe they do some bad work. So they do the bad work, the client sees the bad work, the client gets upset, and then we, as the agency, we're like, well, we're overworking them already, so we'll just won't charge for that work. And so all of the extra work that they did when they didn't have the capacity to do great work gets written off anyway. But then we have to do more work to make up for the work that we wrote off. So it sounds lovely. Everybody wants to go start an agency now, I can just tell. That's how a lot of agencies work, with a lot of other just nastiness built in there. Will, because I got a 4, remember? Our whole team will be fulfilled by their efficient, excellent work for our clients that drives growth for their businesses and creates additional growth opportunities for our team members. Again, lovely again, right? Well, I wish we all wanted to. And then finally, can we can balance lower hourly expectations on our team with increased accountability on the work. So what if we did less work, but all of that work was good, so we didn't have to discount any of it. And when we had to discount the work, we held the team that did the poor work accountable. Like, we can do that. Like, we can at least try it. And we did. 2 years ago, we made a switch in our agency to do that. And 2 things happened. Everybody, we had a lot of clarity meetings where we were like, all right, this is what's happening. You're going to have a less hours expectation, but we're going to have more accountability. And then we did that. And they had less hours, and they liked that, and we had more accountability, and they didn't like that as much. But they liked that more than the more hours. And so we actually gained a lot of ground, and like revenue went up, and it was a good thing. So that's just one example of Ought Is Canwell. It's a little bit more in the depth of our business. But what's fun about this is it's not, like, the first time I learned this framework, I was at a coffee shop and it was written down on a napkin and I got it, right? And I went back and I could put it into play. And so the best way to explain that to you guys is to spend some time putting it into play. So with that, I need a volunteer. Anybody want to volunteer? Tiffany is only volunteering because she knew that I would volunteer her. So, Tiffany, what industry are you in?
Real estate.
Okay. What, and anybody in the room, but especially you, what ought to real estate have been?
Real estate should have been, I go even bigger than just like my company. I go to real estate should have been places for all people. Mm. Everybody should have home. Everybody should have home.
Okay.
Do you want me to go just to my business?
No.
Okay.
I think that's great. That's great, because I think everybody can understand like the industry, and I think that's a great place to start. Okay. What is it today?
The real estate industry today is cutthroat. Money wins all things. Companies buying up people's homes for profit and churning through human lives, like not just the consumers, but the agents as well. It is our deadlines are 11:59 p.m. every day, 1 minute off.
What will it be when it's perfect?
It will be my vision for what it will be a fun process that brings joy with fulfilling lives for the people who work in it with balance.
Okay. This is where I like everybody to kind of join in. What you guys have heard, the ought is and the will, what can it be? Like, what bridges the gap between where it is right now and what it will be when it's perfect? Yeah.
So she's kind of talking about the industry, and it seems like the can is more of, okay, now on a personal level, what we can do.
So I think we can advise our sellers to make human decisions. We can put in place guardrails for the people that work in our business that the industry doesn't automatically put into place. And we can take risks to do this in a way that other people have never seen before. That's how I think of the can, to bridge that. Like, all right, here's the industry. What can Fikes Realty Group do?
Do you guys see that? You see how it works, how it's easy to create. You see, I would be tempting to go into that will and create a mission and vision around the will and totally miss out on the change that you can be a part of, that you can bring to that. Okay?
It strikes me as similar to the medical and insurance flawed system and the gouging, the price gouging, and all that happens with that. Is, and I think we all in this room know what we can do and what we need to do, but it's difficult to stamp out greed, right? Mm-hmm. At the large scale that we see that it's out of control and rampant. And so while agencies and different groups can make a stand and say, we're going to not be greedy, we're going to advise our sellers to sell at a fair price and make sure that everybody is in a level playing field kind of thing, it's difficult, I think, that's a scary proposition because it's difficult to survive mm-hmm. when you're one of the only ones trying to make that radical shift, mm-hmm. and you're fighting against this monstrous empire that continues to want to take more away, right?
Yep.
So maybe, I don't know if there's a way to speak to that, because that seems to be the why we haven't made that shift in a lot of yep. these industries that are flawed and broken.
But that's such an excellent point, and that's the knotted up brokenness right. I'm talking about. Because here's the thing, if we're being really honest, maybe ours is one of them, if the future state, the perfect state, is your industry might be the best in that, right? But and yet it does, and it needs you to engage in that knotted up brokenness. And it may be, we can't change all of that, because you can't survive if you change all of that. But what are the things that, again, what are the things that you can do? What are the little tweaks that you can make? And I think, like, we're still learning this a ton. Like, there's still a ton of brokenness in our agency. But at the same time, as we address some of these industry-wide brokenness, like, we stand out. So, like, when people that have worked at other agencies come to our agency, like, they're like, okay, why is nobody here at 5 o'clock? Or why are your hourly goals lower? Or, like, all right, I tried to email somebody this weekend and they didn't email me back. Like, what's going on? And you start to attract the type of people that care about engaging that brokenness as you engage that brokenness.
But if you look at it like this, especially on the insurance and even the real estate part, we can't control the variables. We can't control the FIDs. We can't control stock shareholders. We can't control because, mm-hmm. as David just said downstairs, you shouldn't apologize for making profit, right?
Exactly.
But those are parameters that we have no control over, right? Now, I can control how I educate the client, how I treat the client, how I give everybody the same
yep.
information distributed across the board equally, but there's certain things that just drives the needle. Mm-hmm. And if you're selling a product, mm-hmm. you can't change the price. Now, in your world, you may be able to, in marketing, you may be a little bit more flexible and say, hey, well, you know what? We're going to charge, I don't know, $5 for this commercial versus we would charge $250.
Yeah.
But if you have a product that's driven by what you have to sell and you can't control those variables because credit comes into play, loss history comes into play, there are so many other moving needles. Does this person have pre-existing conditions? Mm-hmm. There are so many different needles that move that it's hard to say that I'm going to charge you a set rate. So when I look at this, it's kind of remind me like a vision statement, what you're going to do to help people, because sometimes you just can't help the outside stuff that you can't control. So the thing that you can control is the people that come through those doors and how you facilitate that conversation with them.
Yeah, that's great.
I think recognizing where God is calling you in the can mm-hmm. is also really important, because my can is different than somebody else's necessarily
exactly.
in the industry. And so, and when it's scary and, you know, you can't control these things, it's that, yeah, but this is the can I was called to. This is my can. And that means not every customer is for me, and I have to be okay with that. And that's the part of listening that we skip, because we tell God our can more often than we ask and listen for what is our can in this that feels overwhelming.
I appreciate that. I think that's, you're right, knowing that scope of what I can control. And so, while the storm's flying all around you, figuring out how to create that safe haven, even in a small pocket there, mm-hmm. to say we're going to look different, we're going to stand out, but people are going to be drawn to that, where it will gain, hopefully, more space at some point.
Yeah.
I think there's like a natural inclination when we look at the word "can" to think about what can I do.
Yeah.
I think in my mind, I'm thinking in the can, how can I become more curious? How can I pray differently?
Yes.
And how can I, like, I think about the parable of the talents, and the two that doubled were the two that assumed the identity of their master. The one that buried into their own identity is the one that, like, didn't please the master. So it's like, how do I have more identity of my master? How do I get more curious and ask better questions? And anything that I feel like I should do, I probably shouldn't, because anytime I've learned that the more I try to control or I try to change things, the more I break it.
Mm-hmm.
And it really is about posture. So I think the can should reflect more about us pursuing God than anything.
It's joining him where he's already at work. But there are keys of like where should we be? Like where, like there is work that we have to do, and there's work that we need to do. And I think that like that balance between the will and the can, like it's really seeking discernment there. And like where God, where do you have me in this moment? How should I engage this? And not letting go. I think like that's the thing is like I love it when people are called into ministry from like the workplace. And I love it even more when people are called deeper into their work in the workplace. Like those are both what we need, right? It's what if we're gonna make change. And so any other notes before we start to wrap up? Because I won't. Yeah, yeah.
I just wanted. We just bought a house and sold a house, and I wanted to just share, like, just kind of put in this context what you were sharing. Like, so part of my frustration, like on both sides, like with buying and with selling, is it was treated just as a commodity transaction, and like for us, it's like this is a place we're going to raise our four children, and so it's really meaningful to us. But our realtor, the way the process was engaged, it was just a commodity transaction. And so I was frustrated on the buy side. And then the same thing with the sell side is like our desire is like we've had this house for 10 years, we've raised our children, it's precious to us. We want to make money on it, so it's not like we want to sell to another family. But there was nothing in the process to even try that. Like, and so I would have liked for our listing agent to have some kind of process to even ask us, say, hey, what's most important to you? Where we can say, you know what? We want to make money, but we also want it to go to a family. Given the housing crisis in America, like I would like for it to go to a good family. And so, like, what can my agent do to help that process? And on the buy side, maybe it's like, hey, and we ended up taking this in our own hands. I was like, listen, we're going to write a letter to the seller, and I want you to submit it. But if my agent instead said, hey, you know what would be help us to be competitive? Let's put together a really good letter, and I want you to tell about your family so that it personalizes you, so that. Because not every seller is going to care about that, but some will. So like, it's a numbers game, right? And so I wish on both sides, like the agents had a process to capture that. Maybe that's something that can differentiate you and your business, is like to be able to do that. Because I think there's a frustration for.
I'll give you my card. We have all those.
That's
next time.
That's a great point. Yeah. What just happened right there is like if you're struggling with like what can we do, like. Your clients,
customers,
people that are engaging in your industry, they provide great insight for you to consider how to engage. So thank you so much for sharing. All right, so we got just 5 minutes left.
Good job.
Yeah.
Oh, I just was gonna say sometimes in the can there's a the solution is sometimes you're opposed to the solution you come up with. Like, to me, the can for that particular instance is to regulate and kick BlackRock and Vanguard out of real estate. But you know, I don't really like regulation.
Yeah.
So like, you come to a point where you're like, I'm actually of two minds.
Yeah.
And you know.
Well, and I think that's where discernment comes in, is because some of that has to slide a little bit more to the will. Like they will be gone at some point, right? But they're not right now. And so that's the value of really like hanging in with the king. So does this resonate? Like, is this helpful? Okay, good. All right. So I just, one of the things that I find is that not enough conversations like this happen. Okay. We know people that do work and we know people that go to church, but like a lot of times, unless it's like in the industry or whatever, they're not crossing paths. And I think that one of the cans that I feel like I can do in the realm of faith and work is just encourage you that if you don't know, there are so many conversations going on in the world right now about faith and work that like I had no idea about. And it seems like every time I get introduced to another conversation, it goes deeper and deeper and deeper, and there's more and more people. And so there's almost this, like, I don't want to get, like, this silent majority even that are very interested in this and actively, like, pursuing it. And so I brought a couple of resources. One is that this is Every Good Endeavor, Tim Keller, if you haven't read this. I would very like start there. Like it's such a great book. I actually just buy this book at used bookstores, so this is an extra copy. If anybody wants it, just come get it. It's right there. This is a book that I feel obligated to tell you about because it has a horrible name and nobody's gonna buy it because of the name, but it's called Super Habits. But really what it is this professor in American Catholic University in DC has dug into all of Thomas Aquinas' work on virtue. And he has connected virtue to habits. And in terms of, like, he describes virtues as muscles that we must exercise. And so he's pulled out a few what he should have called like almost like super virtues that really highlight those points. And super great read, even though it's a quick read, horrible name. Let's see. This is just an example of, this is called, again, Journey of Leadership. It's a book from McKinsey, actually. And what I want to highlight in here is actually chapter 12. The title of this chapter is For People to Care, Show Them You Care. And so just want you guys to know, McKinsey has written a book on leadership that prioritizes care for the employee. And I'll let you read it and make your own judgment about the people that they are interviewing in here. But it's, if they're not believers, like they're talking like it. I think you don't connect McKinsey and believers a lot of times. Finally, anything by Patrick Lencioni is great. This is the ideal team player. Just happened to be what I have in my car. Love Five Dysfunctions of a Team. His books are around business. He writes amazing, really easy to read books about business. But now he actually runs a podcast that I think is focused almost more on church growth. But a very, very strong believer in the space, but also very respected in the business world. That's just the tip of the iceberg. Like, so if you're working through this frame, you're like, I like this, I'm gonna try it, and you get stuck or anything, let's have coffee. I would love to talk to you about it. Last thing, I wouldn't be true to myself if I didn't show you Jaber Crow by Wendell Berry and make a plea to read fiction. Like, we are boring ourselves to death reading business books and reading theological books that are fantastic. Please keep reading those. At the same time, like, God is creative. When you go back and read Genesis 1 through 3, may you be overwhelmed by his work and by his creativity. And creativity exists in fiction. And so I would just, again, this is another book that if anybody wants, is here for the taking.
What's it called again?
Jaber Crow.
Anything by Wendell Berry.
So it's a fantastic read. Thank you guys so much.
Thanks, Josh.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.